Hi, this is Jessica Aldridge from Eco Justice Radio. Check us out on KPFK at our new time, Fridays from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Join us as we present environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame intended to amplify community voices, broaden the reach of grassroots-based movements, and inspire action. That's Eco Justice Radio, Fridays at 4 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles. And remember to support the station by visiting kpfk.org to make your donation.
Yo, this is Immortal Technique. Right now, you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles. Revolutionary commentary. You know what it is. KPFK, bringing you the realness. Peace.
Harlem streets stay flooded in white powder.
Welcome to Gray Zone Radio on Pacifica. I'm Max Blumenthal, the editor of thegrayzone.com and your host for the next hour. This week, we'll bring you up to date on the latest from the ever-escalating Ukraine proxy war and share some comedy relief with our friend and fellow Pacifica host, Randy Credico. But first, me and my colleague Aaron Mate review the recent gathering of global elites and Western leaders in Davos, Switzerland, at the World Economic Forum, where the war in Ukraine took center stage. Take a listen.
I think it is important to talk about the World Economic Forum in Davos. We've done it before. We've had Jeremy Lofredo on. He actually covered it from Davos last year. He was one of those reporters who was trying to chase down global predators in the streets and confront them and to ask people what they thought about it, just average people on the street. And as Jeremy pointed out, this year is a little bit different. He covered something called Russia War Crimes House last year, where basically every year in Davos, the Russian delegation, which, you know, consists of people who wanted to be part of the global capitalist elite, hosted a Russia House where they featured Russian culture, Russian art, Russian food. And Russia House was seized in Davos under the auspices of the World Economic Forum and turned into Russia War Crimes House. Jeremy covered that, and we have a segment on our YouTube channel about that. But now that's that whole fervor for supporting the Ukraine proxy war has expanded massively. And that really is the centerpiece. The proxy war is the centerpiece of this gathering at Davos, for a lot of reasons. Now, first, let's kind of try to understand what Davos and the World Economic Forum is. It's run by, presided over by a German cartoon villain who looks like he comes out of Austin Powers central casting, named Klaus Schwab. And he is the author of a book called The Great Reset and the concept of the Great Reset. And on the right, they're focused on it, very opposed to it. The left has had a very muted response to it, because the left, and I'm not just talking about the Democratic Party, but all the way to the radical left, they generally went along with all of the pandemic protocols, supporting lockdowns, supporting vaccine mandates, digital passports, and all of these mechanisms that were meant to usher in a Great Reset. But that wasn't the point of the Great Reset, although that was the subtitle of the book. The subtitle of the book by Klaus Schwab was The Great Reset, COVID-19. The Great Reset is about ushering in a fourth industrial revolution in which everything will be digitized and the biological will be merged with the digital. That's what's called transhumanism. And this will become a major source of profits for a global capitalist elite that is in trouble right now and is running out of profits and means of extracting surplus value from the global population, because we're in a post-industrial era. The population that is meant to, that was supported and brought into the West, or brought up in the West as, you know, part of this middle class to industrialize the West, is no longer needed. Yuval Noah Hariri, who's a contributor to the World Economic Forum, sort of the brains behind Klaus Schwab, refers to that part of the population in the Rust Belt that was outsourced with NAFTA as useless eaters, as a surplus humanity, essentially what the population in the Gaza Strip is to Israel. And so the Great Reset brings together predatory capitalism with some ideas that have been pushed in socialism, like UBI, universal basic income for that population to essentially temporarily keep them alive. So how does this tie into Ukraine? Well, first of all, under the banner of the Advantage Ukraine initiative that Zelensky's pushing, Ukraine is pledged to become a cashless, digitized society that is one of the most efficient technocratic societies on Earth as part of its rebuilding program after the reconstruction after the war. And you can go to the Ukrainian embassy in DC and see Advantage Ukraine banners. Ukraine is open for business, but it's open for business to this class that's gathered in Davos. And they are a different capitalist class than the, you know, extraction industry guys in Texas who are just trying to get as much money out of the ground as possible. They're thinking long-term. They have a vision and they have a very clear ideology, which is spelled out through the Great Reset. And so Ukraine is this, now that the pandemic is over and now that Afghanistan is over, Ukraine is the next thing that will help them accelerate this program. And of course, it's also a big cash cow for the arms industry and for big tech, which is making a lot of money with contracts. Me and Aaron, when we were banned in Portugal from speaking at Web Summit, this major tech conference, Microsoft came in and cut a $400 million deal with Zelensky's wife. So that's what this is about. Now let's listen to some of the rhetoric from inside the building. This is Sanna Marin. She is the prime minister of Finland, and she is young. She likes to party. She, you know, leaked video came out showing her partying. She apparently enjoys Molly or something, you know, someone, you know, you should be able to relate to. She posts pictures of herself going to punk rock concerts and rock festivals, you know, dressed like a Vice hipster on her Facebook page. And she shares like 800 kilometers of border with Russia. Finland was traditionally a neutral country, and she has broken that neutrality and signed up to join NATO. She is also a World Economic Forum Davos pet project. She was a World Economic Forum young leader. And you'll sense that someone, it's almost like she's being animated here to say this, but this is the core message that you're hearing at Davos right now from its most telegenic, well-prepared puppet, Sanna Marin. Here she is.
We don't know when the war will end, but we have to make sure that it will end. Ukrainians win. I don't think that there's any other choice. If Russia would win the war, then we would only see decades of this kind of behavior ahead of us. I think other countries are looking very closely what is happening now in Ukraine. And if Russia would win, then it would send a message that you can invade another country, you can attack another country, and you can gain from that. We don't know.
So Aaron, what's your instant, your first reaction to those comments?
So there's another clip too, where she says, we have to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. She says, I don't care if it's 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 15 years. Yeah, and that's my fault. I meant to grab that clip. So that's the one I meant to grab. And that's, you know, as you pointed out on Twitter, you said, you know, something like Sanna McCain, right? Because right. That's what McCain said about the war in Iraq, that we have to stay there for as long as we need to. And what's amazing is if you're a neocon in Washington, you can't be more thrilled than with this current global climate, political climate, where basically your agenda is now the mainstream. Like, whereas after the Iraq war and no WMDs turned up and, you know, that turned into the mess that it was, the neocon brand was very discredited and it was sort of disparaging to be known as a neocon. But now look at it. You have even like the face of like, you know, modern Europe, these young leaders like Sanna Marin or Sanna McCain sounding indistinguishable from a neocon. The same thing you can say about the progressives and the Democratic Party when it comes to at least the war in Ukraine, where they're all unanimously on board. And Ilhan Omar, who's supposed to be like, you know, the face of like the resistance, the new, the left inside the Democratic Party taking on the establishment, she's like lecturing anti-war protesters who ask her like why she's approving billions of dollars in proxy war funding, especially after Ilhan Omar once warned that that would be disastrous. And now Ilhan Omar is lecturing people who take the same position she initially took and saying that they're basically repeating Russian propaganda. So that's where we're at. It's an incredible achievement for the neocons. And, you know, on your point about the financial aspect of this, there's an article in the Washington Post by a columnist named Ishan Tharoor,
Yeah.
And it's
he's related to Shashi Tharoor of the Indian Congress Party. And, you know, but he supports pretty much the liberal interventionist wing of the U.S. foreign policy establishment.
Yeah. So it's a dispatch from Davos because he's there covering it, of course. and listen to this. Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, spoke of his plans to help coordinate billions of dollars worth of reconstruction financing for Ukraine, saying he hoped the initiative would turn the country into a, quote, beacon of capitalism. David Solomon, CEO of Goldman Sachs, spoke cheerily of Ukraine's post-war future. There is no question that as you rebuild, there will be good economic incentives for real return and real investment. So think about that. Like right now, in real life, Ukraine's being destroyed. Like, its soldiers are being sacrificed. They've just lost some key strategic areas. Russia stepped up its attacks ever since Ukraine attacked the Kerch Bridge a few months ago. That led to a huge wave of Russian attacks targeting civilian infrastructure. And these people are in Davos, people who are architects of this proxy war, profiting off of it, already cheerily looking ahead to how they can turn Ukraine into what the head of BlackRock calls a beacon of global capitalism. So that's an illustration of how, you know, Ukrainian lives are completely subordinate to the overall aim, which is just bleed Russia and also, you know, increase their economic power, find new economic markets, increase their domination of the world. And this is an open celebration of that.
Yeah, exactly. Those quotes perfectly illustrate the point that I was making about why Ukraine has taken center stage at the World Economic Forum. Along with climate change, which is bringing in renewable energy, which is a $3 trillion potential profit center for the capitalist elite and corporations. It's not really about saving the earth, and it's questionable whether renewables can actually supplant energy sources like extraction, like fossil fuels or nuclear. Nuclear is seldom considered here, but I got a little bit off the point. Precisely to your point, Aaron, here is Mikhailo Fedorov of the Ukrainian Ministry of Digital Transformation, which was in business officially with FTX, the scam of Sam Bankman-Fried, indicted crypto hustler Sam Bankman-Fried. And the Ukrainian government, as R. Kit Klarenberg reported, was apparently given advance notice of FTX's impending demise and implosion ahead of time. So this is a video that was actually put out last summer to promote Ukraine as a digital fourth industrial revolution paradise after this disaster of war. It's classic disaster capitalism.
Let's look 8 years ahead. 2030. The history of the new Ukraine is studied all over the globe. Why? Because Ukraine became the most digital and convenient country in the world. Scripts have replaced bureaucrats. 500,000 former public servants are successfully integrated in the new economy. No more red tape, but paperless. No more banknotes, but cashless. Yes, we became the first country to abandon paper money. Ukraine now has the best tax system for the IT industry and the most affordable e-residency. Thanks to Ukrainian engineers and programmers, the R&D centers of the world's top technology companies operate successfully, and Ukraine ranks first in the world by the number of startups per capita. Ukrainian courts are guided by artificial intelligence, and all notarial acts take place online. Ukrainian customs is fully automatic and the fastest in the world. Customs clearance and car registration can now be done in 3 clicks from your smartphone. Because of war and internal migration, we have built the most flexible and modern digital education. Brave military and civilians get quality treatment with modern remote monitoring and e-health systems. Ukraine also has the most effective cyber defense in the world. After the horrors of 2022, Ukraine focused on security systems. Now every production facility has its air defense system, and the sleep of Ukrainians is protected by an ultra-modern Iron Dome. The Ukrainian government is digital, more like an IT company in terms of the efficiency of implementing decisions, and one can register a land plot, start construction, open a business or get a license, and register a car or real estate from a smartphone automatically in one click. Ukraine is the freest and digital. This is all because international partners and the world's leading technology companies supported the Digital for Freedom initiative and united to help Ukraine recover through digitalization. Building a new Ukraine together, free and the fastest, brave and digital.
So that's it almost seems like they're happy about the war, that they're Absolutely. Happy about the invasion. They're excited. And ultimately there will be, we'll talk about this later, Ukraine's anti-aircraft systems and some serious misfires, if you can call them that, in recent days. But you know, they're putting forward this image which very much resembles Israel, of a Spartan state in permanent war that is completely protected from attacks, but brave soldiers will continue to be fighting, obviously, and they'll get the best medical care through telemedicine, which is horrible. Telemedicine is not going to give you the best care. But the subtext is permanent war in Ukraine, and it will bring in a digital utopia, because Israel is in a state of permanent war. And Zelensky himself has said that Ukraine will be a big Israel.
They even name drop Iron Dome. I mean, they don't even hide that part.
Yep.
And of course, there are people who question the efficacy of Iron Dome in terms of its stated purpose of shielding the country from missile attacks. But regardless, that's totally my impression too, that this sounds like Israel. And of course, that's exactly what they want. Another client state of the U.S., digitized, running on the military industrial complex and completely, acting as a surveillance state on anyone that it chooses to. That is quite something.
You've been listening to my discussion with Aaron Mate on the recent gathering of global elites and Western leaders in Davos, Switzerland at the World Economic Forum. We'll now continue our discussion about the warmongering in Davos and offer some vital context on the Ukraine proxy war that would be forbidden to mention on a World Economic Forum panel or in our mainstream media. And we'll examine the latest U.S. plans to bring the war to Russian territory, even at risk of nuclear retaliation.
I mean, this is one of the most shocking moments from Davos, and hilarious. I mean, you gotta just kind of laugh at these freaks. This isn't just anybody, though. It's the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, who is a prime minister of Norway as a social democrat, I believe. And, you know, this isn't someone coming from the far right.
It is extremely important that President Putin doesn't win this war, partly because it will be a tragedy for the Ukrainians, but it will be very dangerous for all of us. Because then the message to authoritarian leaders, not only to Putin, but also other authoritarian leaders, is that when they use brutal force, when they violate international law, they achieve what they want. And that will be a very bad and dangerous lesson. It will make the world more dangerous and us more vulnerable. And that's the reason why, if we want a negotiated peaceful solution to the war in Ukraine, we need to provide military support to Ukraine. That's the only way. Weapons—they are the way to peace.
Okay, wait. We got to hear that again.
Rewind.
Weapons—they are the way to peace.
And then you can see that NATO promoted that video. An official NATO logo, which is a converted swastika, comes on screen. So NATO is proud of what Stoltenberg is saying there. This is a message that they want to send. Weapons are the way to peace, which obviously is, I hate to use this term, but it is Orwellian, you know, war is peace, weapons bring peace.
Yeah.
But what your thoughts?
I mean, yeah, look, could be a great new anthem. Like maybe you two could take the lead on this and put out a new anthem for Ukraine proxy war called Weapons Are the Way to Peace. But this is, I mean, see, what is even his job, Jens Stoltenberg, as the NATO Secretary General? He doesn't actually have a military role because NATO has a military council. So they handle that. So what is he actually, like, what's his job? It's basically to be a spokesperson for whatever the U.S. government wants him to say and to sell weapons and to hawk to taxpayers in NATO countries the need for them to spend their money on weapons. Like, that's basically what his job is. And so accordingly, he has to come up with creative ways to sell it. So I guess this is what he came up with. Weapons are the way to peace, because he recognizes that people don't want a war. They want peace. And so his way to sell them on more weapons is to say that this will help bring them peace. But look, I mean, everyone forgets, this is not some case. Like, you don't have to support Russia's invasion to recognize that there's a long background to this, that Russia was provoked, that all the warnings from top U.S. officials like George Kennan, William Burns, that a NATO membership, NATO expansion was a red line for Russia, the coup in Ukraine. I mean, all the things we've talked about. But also, there's a background, and the background includes that Russia put out detailed proposals to NATO and to the U.S. about a year ago, just over a year ago, in December 2021. These long draft treaties laying out all Russia's concerns about NATO expansion, about the positioning of NATO weaponry on Russia's borders, right? For example, it's because Russia doesn't have Russian weaponry in Canada or Mexico, but the U.S. has heavy offensive weaponry surrounding Russia. And Russia wanted to address all that. Russia also wanted to finally see the implementation of the Minsk Accords, which is the agreed upon peace deal for ending the civil war that began in Ukraine after the 2014 coup, and that Ukraine refused to implement because the Ukraine government was basically taking the side of its far right nationalists who didn't want any kind of accommodation that recognized the rights of ethnic Russians instead of Ukraine. So Russia put out proposals to address all of this. And what was the U.S. response? They wouldn't even discuss the core issues. You know, the core issue for Russia, for example, was NATO expansion and the placement of and the rollback of NATO weaponry in NATO states. Russia proposed to NATO and the U.S., like, you can keep your troop deployments, you can keep your offensive weapons, but except in the states that you've expanded to after 1997, we want to see your weapons rolled back there. So keep your weapons in all these states that you have, including ones that are pointed at us, but in the states where you've placed weapons after 1997, when you brought in like a whole new wave of states, including the Baltic states, those have to be rolled back because those are too close to us. And based on that, the U.S. refused to even discuss it. So the idea now that the only way to peace is through more war is just a lie, because there's already been out there proposals on the table to address this, which could easily be revived. But the official position is it's hegemony over peace. And any agreement that constrains the U.S.-led NATO system is deemed to be off limits. And so they just don't even want to discuss it. And who has to pay the price? It's Ukrainians, who will continue to be sacrificed under the mantra of weapons are the way to peace.
And the next NATO Secretary General, the one being put forward by the U.S., is the Canadian Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, who I don't want to call her a Nazi, but she definitely is pretty enthusiastic about Nazis in Ukraine.
Her grandfather was a Nazi. I mean,
her grandfather, Michael Chomiak, indirectly worked for Adolf Hitler. Yeah. His publication, based in Ukraine and in Poland, was funded through Hitler's information ministry. He worked under Joseph Goebbels. He lived in the seized property of a Jew in Poland. He supported the Nazi Germany, and she lied about it. And then two Russian diplomats in Canada who brought this up before the media were deported for telling the truth about her. And not only that, she worked for the Encyclopedia of Ukraine, which her grandfather, Michael Chomiak, started. And if you look in the Encyclopedia of Ukraine, the way they talk about Stepan Bandera is pretty positive. Mm-hmm. The leader of the Nazi collaborator OUNB forces. She also wrote for a Ukrainian diaspora publication. She was put up for this job when she was starting her journalistic career in Canada, which ran ads for neo-Nazi summer camps for youth, Bandera Summer Camp, which these ads in the classified section of the paper that would have Chrystia Freeland articles would actually have SS, Galicia SS logos and iron crosses. I mean, it's pretty sick stuff. And when the war erupted in February, she went out to a rally in Ottawa and held up an OUNB red and black flag, the flag of the Nazi collaborator partisan army in Ukraine. So this is the person that the U.S. is putting up, at least right now, has announced as its possible preference for NATO Secretary General. It really speaks to what NATO is and always has been. But, you know, moving along, I mean, there's just endless comments at Davos, we are standing with Ukraine until this war is won by General James Cleverly. But here's a more I think, consequential figure, and it's the leader of Poland, Andrzej Duda, the president. And, he's right there on the border with Ukraine. I always, find it peculiar how they balance the historical reality that Bandera, the hero of the post-Maidan regime, has slaughtered so many ethnic Poles, and he's being honored officially by the Ukrainian parliament and Poland's support for this war. And I guess it's just the shared hatred of Russia.
And I know very well that Ukraine needs weapon, as I said yesterday, and once again, weapon. Weapons are crucial now because this war is really very difficult. This is not the end of the war. Russia is not defeating. They are still Russians. They are still very strong.
They're still Russians.
A lot of Russian soldiers on the front line, and we are afraid that they are preparing. Now they are preparing themselves for the new offensive in a few months, probably.
Well, that's true.
So this is crucial to send now additional military support to Ukraine, especially modern tanks, especially modern missiles, to defend Ukraine, but first of all, to stop Russian offensive.
Okay, Aaron, Germany is being asked to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine. These are very good tanks. And Germany's closer than the U.S. And Germany has said, well, we'll send them if you send the M1A1 Abrams tanks. And the U.S. is saying, well, these tanks are too heavy and the engine is difficult to repair. The Ukrainians aren't trained in them.
It's interesting. And, look, it's possible that the U.S. is being sincere here when they say that the Abrams tank, it's too clunky. It wouldn't work for Ukraine. It requires too much maintenance. It's also possible they're worried that it would be embarrassing for them to send it and have it perform badly, which has happened to the U.S. before. Like in Syria, for example, I think some of its weaponry sent to the rebels didn't perform so well. That's possible. Another possibility, though, and this was raised by recently by a German parliamentarian who is really principled, one of the few, her name is Sevim Dagdalin. And she wrote an article basically saying that a main motivator, she thinks, for this push for the U.S. for this pressure by the U.S. on Germany to send German tanks, combined with the U.S. refusal to send its own tanks, is that the U.S. wants to basically push Germany into the crossfire so that if there's any Russian retaliation for this, for sending tanks off to battle Russian forces, that Germany faces it militarily and also politically, because Germany has always been, it's always had ties to Russia. Angela Merkel had a somewhat cooperative relationship with Putin. There was, of course, the Nord Stream 2, which the U.S. successfully sabotaged. But Germany is still the key to an off-ramp. And there's always been an effort to rupture relations between Germany and Russia, because if there's no ties between Germany and Russia, then U.S. dominance is secure. So what she's saying is that, this could be an effort by the U.S. to get Germany into the crossfire militarily and politically to ensure that, German-Russian relations are permanently damaged, which would be the case if Germany is sending off tanks to fight Russian forces. And it's just funny to see this play out. And Germany has always been hesitant about this war. Before the war, it tried to engage in some diplomacy to avoid it. Schultz said to Zelensky, there's that, this report in the Wall Street Journal that, Schultz begged to Zelensky, how about we'll give you security guarantees as long as you pledge neutrality not to join NATO. And Zelensky rejected it. This was days before Russia invaded. And so Germany's made an effort, and they didn't want to commit to killing the Nord Stream 2. But finally, the Biden administration forced them to shut it down. And then to make sure that it permanently was shut down, somebody blew it up. We all know who it is. It had to have been the U.S. and its allies. And now Germany's facing this new round of pressure. And if history is a guide, I do think they'll cave. but it's interesting to me that they haven't so far. And I think that the aspect of why would the U.S. be so insistent that German tanks go to Ukraine, but not the U.S.'s own tanks? You mean to tell me that U.S. has no tanks that are suitable for Ukraine? So on the one hand, the U.S. is claiming that, you know, they're fighting the new incarnation of Hitler. They're fighting to save civilization and save democracy from this tyrant. We have to do everything we can. But yet they're also saying, oh, we can't send you our own tanks. So something's going on there. Maybe they don't want to get embarrassed. Maybe they don't want to get embarrassed because the Abrams tank is a bad tank. I don't know. Or they just really want to sacrifice Germany and make sure that Germany and Russia never have any hope of having ties again.
Well, I think that's it. And we have Carlos Del Toro, the U.S. Navy secretary, stating that if the proxy war continues for 6 months more, it may become, in his words, challenging to maintain supplies to the U.S. military. In other words, the Ukraine proxy war is hurting the U.S. military, though it might be very good for orders from U.S. arms manufacturers and the MIC. And then at the same conference that Del Toro spoke at, Admiral Darrell Caudill, who's the commander of the U.S. Fleet Forces, also from the U.S. Fleet Forces Command, also from the U.S. Navy, said that the Navy might get to the point where it has to make the decision whether it needs to arm itself or arm Ukraine. So that's one issue there, is that the U.S. cannot continue to supply Ukraine at the level it needs. And now we need to tie that in to another development. And this is, you know, something that is obviously being managed through hardline elements around the Pentagon through their media stenographers. So it's unclear how serious an initiative this is, but it's an initiative to attack Crimea. And there is a plan to consider attacks via the Ukrainian proxy on the Russian Federation, as I consider it. Crimea is the Russian Federation because a majority of people in Crimea wanted to be part of Russia instead of to be part of this post-Maidan regime that hates ethnic Russians and hates the Russian language and is outlawing the Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate of the Orthodox Church, which is the Orthodox Church. And so from Russia's point of view, it's seen as an attack on Russia. So if the U.S. were to do what's being put forward in this plan, which Aaron isn't sending M1 A1 tanks, but would be sending M1 Bradleys, which have powerful guns and are capable, would be used to try to break Russian lines heading towards Crimea, supplying Bradley fighting vehicles, supplying long-range missiles to attack Russian bases in Crimea. That would be the U.S. attacking Russia. That would be something that we never experienced growing up as Gen Xers during the Cold War. In fact, nothing like that happened during the Cold War. And if you were to tell me this was something that would happen 5 years ago, I would have torn what's left of my hair out. Yeah. This is crazy.
It's nuts. It's nuts.
So does the U.S. even have the capacity to supply them for these attacks? Well, this is what Ukraine wants. Ukraine wants, at least this is what the figures in Kiev want to do. And why they want to do it? It will strengthen Kiev's position in any future negotiations. However, the U.S. is willing to risk escalation. And the hardliners interviewed in this piece, including Philip Breedlove, who's a former U.S. NATO representative, who previously called for U.S. armed intervention in Ukraine. They're saying that there's no way that Russia will deploy a tactical nuclear weapon, and that's why they think it's possible to start attacking Crimea. So they're daring Russia to use a tactical nuclear weapon. That's what this is about. That's where we're at here.
It's nuts. And let's assume they're right, that Russia won't deploy a tactical nuclear weapon. Okay, that's the best case scenario. But you know what Russia will deploy? It will deploy more of its heavy weaponry to target Ukraine on top of what it already has. They're basically asking for a lot more Ukrainians to die, because that's what Russia will make happen if Crimea is attacked with U.S.-made weapons. And we've already seen a iteration of that when, after the Kerch Bridge was blown up with, you know, not heavy weaponry, just a truck bomb, that's when Russia escalated its attack on civilian infrastructure inside of Ukraine massively.
The electrical grid.
Yeah. As was predicted, you know, before this happened, the New York Times back in September reported that U.S. officials are baffled that Russia has avoided civilian infrastructure. And that they feared the most dangerous moments were yet to come. I'm basically quoting the Times there, and they're saying this based on what U.S. officials are telling them. So U.S. officials knew that if Ukraine continued to fight rather than negotiate and escalated its operations, such as attacking Crimea, the Kerch Bridge, they knew it would invite a Russian retaliation. That's exactly what happened. And Ukrainians have suffered for it. And now they're saying they want to do even way more, because we're not talking about a truck bomb of a bridge, which ultimately didn't hurt Russia that much at all. We're talking about using heavy U.S. weapons to attack Crimea, which Russia considers now its own territory. And as you say, the majority of the population there agrees. And they've been trying. I mean, there's been a movement in Crimea, a sizable one, to break off from Ukraine ever since Ukraine was founded in 1991. So it's like, the idea that you're now going to help Ukraine go after a territory where the majority of the population doesn't want to be a part of Ukraine and considers themselves to be a part of Russia, it's pure insanity. And the best case scenario is that Russia doesn't use nuclear weapons. It just kills many, many more Ukrainians when it fires back. Which,
well, a tactical nuclear weapon could wipe out an entire Ukrainian division, as far as I know, and that would be the purpose of it. Yeah. And what would the response be? First of all, from the media, the neocon Beltway press corps would be pushing Biden in the Rose Garden to directly retaliate. I can guarantee that.
Oh, of course. Of course.
I mean, that's what they did for Trump when there were pictures of dead children in Syria. So what do you think they do if a tactical nuke wipes out a Ukrainian division?
I mean, we'd all be done with. That's what happened. It would be over. So these people are constantly willing to flirt with that, and they want to take the risk, and they're basically counting on Putin not to be a madman, you know, not to, they're completely counting on him, whereas they're willing to take all the risks.
The U.S. has always counted on Russian restraint, yeah, as it escalated.
Yep. Yeah.
At the same time, it paints the Russian leader as Hitler.
Exactly. Exactly. It's so incoherent.
Hitler. He's going to invade,
yeah,
Poland and Russia, and he's going to go into France. He's going to fight a two-front war. Just like he's Hitler, but he's restrained and we think he's rational and we can attack his territory and we're willing to do that. And really what this shows is desperation, because they know that Ukraine cannot hold on the way the war is shaping up right now after Bakhmut, because it will be kind of a war of attrition.
Yep.
They call it a World War One style trench war, whatever you want to call it. Ukraine does not have the manpower or the materiel that Russia has. And therefore, they're going to try some desperate escalation to force Russia to the table. And it's not going to happen. It's not going to work. Even if they do it, it will not force the negotiation that they want. They're delusional. These are just the most dangerous people on the planet.
Hi there. It's your host, The Gray Zone Show, Max Blumenthal. You've been listening to me and my colleague Aaron Mate discuss the latest plans to escalate the Ukraine proxy war. Now we'll continue with a look at the latest palace intrigue from Kiev, where a top advisor to Vladimir Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, has been forced to resign after revealing some inconvenient truths about a supposed Russian missile attack on a civilian apartment block in the city of Dnipro.
There have been some interesting and disturbing developments out of Ukraine, some palace intrigues specifically related to one of Zelensky's most influential and certainly most prominent advisors. His name is Alexei Aristovich. He's sort of a psychologist, a professional information warrior, and a very prominent, well-liked Ukrainian media personality who also has some pull among the ethnic Russian population. He speaks to them in their own language and has always argued for them to be included, even as he's put forward the idea that Ukraine can win this war. And one of the things Aristovich is most famous for is predicting a Russian invasion back in 2019, declaring that it would be inevitable, that it was unavoidable, and that Ukraine had to prepare for this confrontation. So he's seen as sort of a sage. But Aristovich made some comments that got him in political hot water. Let's take a listen and watch, because I guess you're going to have to watch and read the subtitles. Okay, so, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Aristovich said live in Dnipro, excuse my Slavic pronunciation, the missiles, well, let's just pause it for a second. So this is what NATO media is saying. The Washington Post had a cover story that Russian missiles attacked a major apartment, a large apartment block in the city of Dnipro in Ukraine. And Britain is going to send battle tanks, sort of, you know, you see how they combine it in the headline to justify the tanks based on the Russian war crime. And there's a photo of the apartment block. It said that scores are killed and injured. This is Reuters coverage. Obviously, the death toll has gone up as Russian missile hits apartment block. This is the major story, the big war crime. And here's the most influential advisor.
Ну, то есть возможности в Днепре сбить вот эту ракету хорошего возможности не было.
Нет, по ее сбили, она упала.
Dnipro was shot down by air defense. After which it fell on the entrance and detonated.
I mean, кроме того, там проблема с едким дымом, наверное, признак Х-22, потому что он заправляется крайне токсичным топливом. И это, судя по всему, тут еще разбираться и разбираться, но можно предположить, что оно стало еще и дополнительным элементом поражения токсичного топлива как такового.
То есть возможности в Днепре сбить вот эту ракету хорошо?
Нет, по ее сбили, она упала на
подъезде.
Она взорвалась, когда упала.
Okay, so there is video showing two detonations on the apartment block there. It strongly suggests that a Ukrainian battery, a SAM battery, brought down a Russian missile, which was not targeting that apartment block. And then this has been happening across Ukraine. Aaron, I'm sure you remember when a Ukrainian SAM battery misfired and landed in Poland, and then Zelensky went to the media and said, Russia has attacked Poland. Russia has attacked NATO territory. This is an Article 5 attack. You need to respond. In other words, he was basically deploying a de facto false flag to get the West to intervene directly. And it turned out, and you know, even Reuters and all the legacy media outlets had to call it out and say, nope, nope, but they're not really retracting the reporting on this.
But initially, remember, Zelensky was backed up by an anonymous senior U.S. official who told a reporter, I can't remember, he was with Reuters or Associated Press, who said that, yes, our assessment is that this came from Russia, that Russia launched this missile. So Zelensky was pushing a lie that Russia bombed Poland, but he was backed up in that by somebody from the U.S. And that led to a reporter who reported that being fired because he didn't obviously check his sources. But I think that reporter should have outed who his source was, because his source gave him false information that could have sparked a world war, which I think is grounds to, you know, ignore journalistic code there and out your source, because this is someone who risked a world war in the U.S. government. And it's, you know, look, I don't know what happened in this missile strike. I do know there are people who have shown the videos that you talked about where, you know, showing what looks like to be an air missile deployed, but I don't have the capacity to judge. What I can say, though, it's telling that this top advisor to Zelensky, who's, you know, very, very close to Zelensky, had to resign just for saying that.
Well, that was the latest from us at the Gray Zone Show and our ongoing coverage of the Ukraine proxy war. Now it's time to turn to our friend, comedian, activist, and fellow Pacifica host Randy Credico for some comic relief, and to assess the sad state of late-night comedy as top network hosts function as court jesters for the Imperial War State.
For me, it's natural to do it in a room full of people who agree with me and share the same sensibility. And that's the same at Jimmy Dore shows. And I don't think I would ever bring it to like a general audience, especially like at a DC open mic where you have people from like, who are like working at Lockheed Martin in the crowd. Like, I mean, maybe just to troll them, but it just wouldn't go over well.
I said last night, listen, for me, it's the same thing. I can't deal with a bridge and tunnel crowd. There's no way I could work at what's really a Chuck E. Cheese pizza comedy club, you know, Chuckles or whatever. You know, I did well over my comedy career politically in three areas, the upper west side of Manhattan, way over there by Columbia, the lower east side over there by Tompkins Square Park, and Havana. Those are the only three places where the audience really got into it. And well, Randy, by the way, has a great sense of humor. You both have a great sense of humor.
Randy, you were killing it when you did the Johnny Carson show.
Yes.
Until you dissed Gene Kirkpatrick.
Yes.
Reagan's demonic ambassador to the UN.
You know,
and that's when Johnny turned on you. But before then, you had the audience in the palm of your hand. They were loving it.
People should
look up that clip. It's on YouTube.
I think it is. You know, I've never seen it myself because I hate watching myself on television. It's like this actor, George Rapp, never watched one of his 225 movies because I always find something that I don't like. And it makes me uncomfortable. Yes, I was doing Reagan. We were talking about the Sandinistas and all of that stuff back then. And I was doing this and that. And then I said something about Reagan's staff and cabinet, Weinberger, William Francis Smith, the whole crew. And I said, and Gene Kirkpatrick. And I said, you know, you look at her and analyze some of the things she says. You have to ask yourself seriously, did Eva Braun die in that bunker in 1945? So that was it, man. But the talent coordinator, Jim McCauley, may rest in peace. He saw that. I had to do that.
Hey, I found it, Randy. Let me play it. This is from a documentary about Randy Credico. It's free on YouTube. It's produced by Jack Black called 60 Spins Around the Sun. I learned about Randy through this. And then I reached out to him and, you know, that's how I know Randy. But here it is.
Randy Credico. Randy.
Handsome young man.
Yeah, look at that.
Look at those teeth.
It was the greatest moment in my life in show business. You know, to hear that you got the Tonight Show was, you got the brass ring. You know what I mean?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Johnny. And what a great introduction. As he said, I do political impressions. And
I'm doing great. You know, I'm doing the Reagan, Jesse Jackson, and Ted Kennedy and all this. And
there was a point where Freddie de Cordova said, this guy's great, right? He's coming back. I thought that I would get the chair. I was doing that well. There was a point where I was going to get the chair. Everyone wants to sit in the chair next to Carson. I mean, he's the king. So you're waiting for the king, you know, to judge you. You know, you submit yourself more to him. You're playing to him. And I was more than to the crowd.
Speaking of Reagan, he did well the other night. Surprised a lot of people. He was quite effective, especially in the beginning when they asked him if there was a secret war planned in Central America after the election, in which he said,
well, let me just say this. You take all these countries, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, now. You line them up diagonally, and you will see that they, in fact, run right into the state of Illinois. I was born and raised in the state of Illinois. I can recall when I was a kid going to the county fair, livestock and exhibits and my first prize.
I was doing very well.
What did you say there? Grub them the wrong way.
There's a couple of things.
Like what?
Jane Kirkpatrick. She is the UN ambassador, and she says a lot of interesting things. As a matter of fact, if you examine some of those statements, you got to ask yourself seriously, did Eva Braun die in that bunker in 1945?
Somebody says, whatever you don't do, Carson. I did like...
Yeah, so...
Yeah. You know, that cost me a lot of money. That cost me a lot of money because my uncle, who was a State Department cover in the CIA back in the 50s in Argentina, ended up owning a lot of cruise ships and land in Italy. And he had no kids, and I was his favorite. And he financed me in 1984 so I could actually work on going on The Tonight Show. Gave me like $5,000. He loved me, but he said just before he died in 2001, he said, you're out of the will now. You're out of the will. I said, for what? Because of what you said 17 years earlier on the Carson. He was a big reactionary, loved Gene Kirkpatrick, Kissinger, and all these neocons. And it's true. I lost 500 acres of land just northwest of Naples because of it two cruise ships and a couple of houses in Coral Gables. That one line, all right? So at any rate, I'm here today, still busting my ass.
It's really good insight when you look at the court jesters of today, whether it's Jon Stewart with his podcast where he cannot bring himself to actually challenge two of the biggest warmongers on the planet, Condi Rice and Hillary Clinton, or all of the late night comedians, Jimmy Kimmel and Stephen Colbert, who's sort of a parody of the former self-satirical nationalist comedian that he's the realization of the former parody that he was at the Colbert Show. All of these comedians are the ultimate propagandists for empire and every other psyop. And so you see, you drop one line and that's the end of you.
These guys are not that bright. First of all, they don't know. They're not that aware. And second of all, if they are, they're just self-censoring. Jon Stewart, I knew him. He was just some rich Long Island kid that broke into comedy. And, you know, he's pretty well educated. But, you know, he also, hammered on one of these shows. He hammered Susan Sarandon after 9/11 when she said that U.S. foreign policy had something to do with 9/11, which it did.
Yeah, I remember that.
So Susan Sarandon said that, and he excoriated her on the David Letterman show. And the David Letterman actually had John Ashcroft on, and they all applauded when they went after Lynn Stewart, and she was put in jail. And John Ashcroft said, "We got this lawyer who had the SAM violations," and he actually had people standing up. David Letterman. So none of these, they
killed her in jail. They killed her and only released her when she was dying of cancer. This is Lynn Stewart. She defended the blind sheik and they cooked up some fake violation to jail her because she had humiliated the federal government again and again, getting off all of their top targets.
Yes, it really was, none of these guys. Carson went after Jim Garrison way back in 1968 when they came out with that indictment of Clay Shaw and everybody. He went after him and hammered the Garrison report. All right. But other than that, Carson was, you know, would take some chances. I can't think of his last name right now, but there were other talk show hosts before that were on late night, David Steinberg, and others who had him back in the 70s who had talk shows who would actually do political humor with a bite. None of these guys do. There's nothing that these guys do right now. It's like Wolf Blitzer doing political humor on the Jimmy Kimmel show or Ari Melber or Nicole Wallace. Any of these individuals, it's no different. They reflect, their humor is in the same vein as the conversations that you would see on CNN or MSNBC. There's nobody out there taking any chances at all. Either they're stupid. Who's the guy who hosts the Tonight Show now? I don't even know his name. There's no way I'm going to watch it. They're just going to fall in line because if they don't fall in line, they're going to lose their gigs. You know, you can't go up and say what you guys are saying. Nobody can say. I mean, as Aaron knows, he was going to come in last week. I couldn't even say where I was hosting a luncheon for Scott Ritter.
That's right.
I could not do that because the place where he was going to do it a few days earlier had to cancel.
Yep.
Because they had these Ukrainian red and blue hysterical people calling up the place and they had to cancel. This is like 1917 to 1921. If he did anything, I mean, it's like Lenox Hills Hospital was German hospital and infirmary. They had to change it. You couldn't hot dogs from Frankfurters. So we have the same hysteria going on right now. Aaron was going to show up the other day, but he got in late. And we sold out that place by me saying one thing on WBA. Thank God you guys are on Sunday at 6 o'clock. It's really a gift to WBA that you were there.
We really thank you, Randy Credico, for all the work you continue to do for the freedom of Julian Assange and for bringing some humor to the situation. Do you want to close out with a, I don't know, Reagan, H.W. Bush, take us out?
I'll do my Bush. George W. Bush, who said, "We are not at war with the people of Iraq. We are at war with the Iraqi people." All right, that's about it.
All right.
we're fighting cicadas. His son said, we gotta go in because we're fighting cicadas. Al cicadas, there's cicadas everywhere. I gotta protect your freedom, the Patriot Act. I wanna hide your freedom to protect your freedom. That's why we gotta sign the Patriot Act.
You've been listening to Gray Zone Radio, and I've been your host, Max Blumenthal. Check out more of our work and sign up for our newsletter at thegrayzone.com. That's G-R-A-Y Zone. This episode was produced by Christopher Weaver.
The Car Show has aired on KPFK since 1973. And perhaps you have a car that's been sitting in your driveway since 1973 or 1993. Or maybe you're still driving it, but it's time to say goodbye. Get rid of that thing and help KPFK at the same time. Your donation of your old car gets it out of your life and helps KPFK as a tax-deductible donation. And not just cars. Trucks, boats, and motorcycles are also welcome. It's easy. Just call 877-KPFK-AUTO and we'll handle all the details. Let your old car help KPFK.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting three-time Grammy winner and MacArthur Fellowship Award recipient Cecile McLaurin-Salvant on Friday, January 27th at 8 p.m. at Royce Hall. Salvant is a composer, singer, and visual artist who unearths the connections between vaudeville, blues, and Baroque music. Nothing she's done can quite prepare listeners for the visceral intensity and genre-obliterating atmospheres of her latest album, Ghost Song, which will be featured in this performance. For more information, visit cap.ucla.edu or kpfk.org.
Sometimes you have a well to see the sky.
Hey, want to brush up on your Spanish and discover a world of news, public affairs, arts and culture? Tune in Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight for KPFK en Español. This Tuesday night, starting at 8 p.m., get your daily dose of Español with Informativo Pacifica. At 8:30, Voces de Libertad. 9:30, Insurgencia Femenina o Suplemento Comunitario. Yes. Remember, get Thursday, 8 p.m. to...
...or to bring you local, national, and international news and views. We are one of the most cutting-edge shows on KPFK and on other Pacifica stations. Want to find out why? Tune in to Sojourner Truth, Tuesday to Friday, 7 to 8 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Hey, Scott Horton here to let you know that Anti-War Radio is moving to Thursday afternoons at 2:30. For a dozen years here on KPFK, I've brought you the best experts, journalists, and activists working to end the American empire. For most of that time on Sunday mornings. But again, starting next week, Anti-War Radio will air every Thursday at 2:30 Pacific time. In the meantime, check out the archives. More than 5,800 interviews going back to 2003 at scotthorton.org. Talk to you Thursday at 2:30.
With the new car business down right now, you might think that we don't need your vehicle donation. However, the market for donated vehicles is very strong. Please donate your old car, truck, RV, or motorcycle to us at 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. Or online at kpfk.org. We'll take care of everything. And you'll help support the quality programming you hear on KPFK. Just call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. Or donate online at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Jessica Aldridge from Eco Justice Radio. Check us out on KPFK at our new time, Fridays from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Join us as we present environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, intended to amplify community voices, broaden the reach of grassroots-based movements, and inspire action. That's Eco Justice Radio, Fridays at 4 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles. And remember to support the station by visiting kpfk.org.